Okay. Today I'm sitting in Prague in the library, awesome library with Pepper de Collier. And we are going to be talking about some stuff related to leadership, right? Attitude in life and stuff like that. And so Pepper, I'd like you to introduce yourself so that we know how you ended up in Prague at the end of the day, because you come from the USA and you work for big corporations, big companies. And so could you tell me what's your story?
Okay. Thank you very much, Jan, for your invitation to talk to you today. Actually, you know, my story is fairly simple. I was raised in the farmland of the central United States in Indiana. And I was not a very good student at all. As a matter of fact, I only went to high school for a year and a half and was asked to leave. I was a discipline problem. And so at that time, my grandfather, who was the real patriarch of our family, said to me, "You know, Pepper, you've got to find something to do. You have to have a trade," is what he said. And so I said, "Okay, but I don't know what I want to do." And he said, "Well, why don't you become a barber?" I said, "Okay." So he paid for me. It was $68 a month. I remember the tuition. He paid for me to go to barber college to become a barber. And at the first Monday of every month, my grandfather would show up at the barber college with my tuition in cash. And he would go in and pay it. And for 18 months, I learned how to become a barber. And so that was my first real job. And so there were a few things that happened that really that changed my life from that point. I was in a barbershop, not in a very nice part of town, and the barber that was on my right, worked the chair on my right, was arrested by the FBI, and he was convicted of racketeering and was sent to federal prison. The one on my left was also arrested for harboring a fugitive. A friend of his had robbed a bank and he hid him in his basement. And so he was convicted of harboring a fugitive and he went to federal prison. And so I began to think if maybe this was kind of a, you know, not the most desirable career path for me. Well, about that same time, the phone rang on a Saturday in the barbershop, and it was the man who basically threw me out of school, Edwin White, and he said, "You know, would you mind coming to see me in my office?" And I said, "Well, for what? You know, I mean, I'm living a pretty good life, and I was making $800 a month, and which was like I was like on top of the world. You know, this is going back, 50 years. That was a pretty good, you know, pretty good living." And he said, "Well, you know, I've just gone through some files, and I'd like to talk to you." And so anyway, I went to see him, and he said, "Look, Pepper, there's nothing wrong with being a barber, but if you think that maybe you'd like to do something else with your life, I'd like to make a suggestion. If you will go to the Department of Education and take a test, if you do well on the test, I will sponsor you at university." So I thought, "Oh, what the heck, you know, why not? I'll do it, I'll try it." So I took the test, I did well on it, and I was accepted to three universities. The Indiana University, Northwestern University, and the University of Arizona. I went to the University of Arizona because in the early 60s, Playboy magazine did an article on the school and said it was the biggest party school in the West. And so I said, "Okay, you know, that sounds pretty good." So, I mean, and I continued my lackluster academic career, and it took me many years to graduate from college, but I finally did. And so then I got into the insurance business, life insurance, and I became the top life insurance agent, rookie agent, in the United States for two companies in two consecutive years. One was the Aetna, which was one of the largest companies in the United States, and the other was Philadelphia Life Insurance, that I went on later to become a member of their board. And then I decided that, I wanted to make a life change. And so I sold my insurance business, which was the first, if not the only time anybody's ever sold a life insurance practice, because it's such a personal business. But one of my competitors wanted me out of the business so bad that he actually bought my practice from me. And so I was on my way to England to take my family, my young family, to live, because I really liked the nature of the British society. At that time, their stand on weapons, everyone was so civil, they'd get in line, they'd queue up for things instead of pushing and so on. So I that'd be a great place to raise my kids. So I went up there and got a house in a little village called Marlow, but we never lived in it because I came back to the United States, and my house, by this time, had not sold. And it represent too much of an asset in my portfolio to just walk away from it. I couldn't do that, and I just didn't want to leave it with a realtor and say, see what you can get for it. So I waited and waited and waited. And some friends of mine said, why don't you get involved in a business with us? And I said, well, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, there's a couple of very wealthy families in the United States. They said, well, we're buying magazines. Would you be interested in maybe being a publisher of a magazine? I said, you guys are crazy. I don't know anything. He said, come on. We just have a product. We need somebody that can sell some things. You can sell things, we'll help you with what you don't know. So that's how I became publisher of Monterey Life magazine in Monterey, California. I went there to turn the magazine around. We had a wonderful success there. Some wonderful, wonderful people joined the team. One of the most famous photographers in history, Ansel Adams, became a contributor and allowed me to use any of his photographs for $25, which was unheard of. One of the most famous cartoonists at the time, Eldon Dedini, who was in Esquire, Playboy, and so on, again, let me use his work. I used one of them on the cover of a magazine for $100, which was a fraction of his. So we just really brought together a wonderful group of people, and it was just great fun. And as a result, I became the finalist candidate for the publisher's job at Ballet News and Opera News, which are the two main publications of the Metropolitan Opera in New York. So I was the finalist candidate, and at the 11th hour, we could not get together on money. We just couldn't do it. I had two young children. Living in Manhattan was going to be very expensive, and so I withdrew from the search. And so anyway, the guy who was doing the search was an icon of the search industry, Lester Korn, who was the founder of Korn Ferry International. So Lester said, well, what do you think of this business? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, the search business. I said, well, I don't know. It looks pretty interesting. He said, well, why don't you come out to Century City, Los Angeles, talk to us about it, and, see what you think. So I did, and that's how I got into the search business. And then I was a partner at Spencer Stewart and Heidrick & Struggles, which were Heidrick & Struggles at the time I was there, was written up by the Wall Street Journal as the most respected search firm in the world at the CEO level. And so through that association, I had the wonderful opportunity to interact with some of the most influential people in business around the world. And I spent my time working with the people after they'd been placed, helping them assimilate into these new environments, helping them, you know, through some of the challenges they had not anticipated, and really got involved in that aspect of it. I mean, this coaching aspect of it. And then over, I would say, a period of many, many years, in fact, going back to the insurance industry, the president of the Philadelphia Life, for example, asked me to coach young agents and so on to help them. It's over 35 years or so. I just really, you know, really grew to love that. And so anyway, about 13 years ago, I retired. I decided to retire. And we were living in San Diego. My wife did not like living in the United States. She was raised in Europe. She's American, but she was raised in Europe. She says, can we go? Can we get out of here? I said, okay. So we tried living in France for a while, in rural France. We tried living in Italy for a while. And while we were in Italy, a friend of ours from Prague came. She was the former ambassador to Egypt. That's how we met her, because we had some family ties in Egypt and we traveled there quite a bit. My mother-in-law lived in Cairo. And she came to visit us at our home in Tuscany, and she said, where are you going? What are you doing? I said, I have no idea. You know, we just want to find a place to live. And she said, have you ever thought of coming to Prague? And I said, Donna, her name's Donna Hunyatova. I said, Donna, I don't even know where it is. I said, on a map, with no names on a map, I don't think I could point to it. So she had the foreign ministry invite me to a meeting that lasted 4 days. While I was in the meeting, my wife was walking around Old Town, and that was the end of our travels. My wife said, it was a Friday afternoon, we got out of the meetings, and she said, can we stay here for a while? We never left. And so that's kind of the long-winded version of how we got here. I absolutely love it. And the Czech Republic has been wonderful, wonderful for us.
Well, I can definitely understand that if she saw that beauty, you know, because I live in China now, and all of my friends, they are just fascinated by Czech Republic when they travel. When I post some picture on social media from the old town and these places, they're just like, oh, I love it. I want to go there, you know. Right. So I can understand it. And you're living here in this area, then I totally understand that.
It's been fantastic. And so anyway, when I got here, I had no idea of doing anything, really. And so I was asked by the, at that time, the sister publication of the Wall Street Journal, which is the economic daily here, Hospodarsky Noviny. I was asked to write a weekly column on leadership. And I did for, I think, about two and a half years. And then started getting calls from people to coach. And so I thought, all right, why not? You know, I'll get back into doing something. It was nice. And so, and then I wrote some books. I wrote a trilogy on leadership called Common Sense Wisdom, which became bestsellers and is now, as you know, on audio. But it just, all of a sudden, it was like this, it just took on a life of its own. And I became more busy than I was when I was actually working full time. And so now what I do is I write. I still have a column. I speak at conferences. I just came back from London, where I spoke for the Economist asked me to come speak about the future of the workplace, the future of leadership. And so that's how I spend my time today. But I'm based here in Prague, and this is where we are going to live.
That's awesome. I definitely recommend the book. I just started reading or listening to the audiobook, and I really like the topics that you are covering. So I will dive deeper. But maybe I can just say that it doesn't matter how many books you read, but you just need to apply those things that you read in the books. And that's what I learned through my experience and through the reading of the books. But that's just a side note. And I'd like to get back, because in the book you mentioned one topic, and that's the serendipity mm-hmm. in your career and its role in your career. And based on this story that you just described, I have a sense that the serendipity played quite a big role in your career, because first of all, it was your teacher that gave you the chance to take the test and choose a different path in life. And then your friend or your colleague that offered you another position or another job in a big company that led to other things in the future. And then you ended up in Prague and many things happened. But could you talk about the serendipity in your career, or maybe even serendipity in general? Because I truly believe that it's something that people shouldn't underestimate.
It's a wonderful, wonderful point that you bring up. First of all, serendipity, the word, comes from an ancient Persian fairy tale about the three princes of Serendip. And these were three young princes that had this unusual ability to find these incredible treasures under a rock or behind an old door or after a long journey to stumble over a diamond, you know, in the desert. I mean, so this is where it came from. It was finding something of extreme value through accident, basically. That's serendipity. So the way I apply that to life, and I've written about it, as you just indicated, because the people I've talked to in life, the leaders I've talked to, all have examples of how serendipity led them into something that either they had not anticipated and turned out to be an incredible experience, or just something that they were thinking about, didn't act on yet, and then the opportunity appeared. So here's what it looks like to me. First of all, I don't believe in accidents. I think that beyond the physical realm of just bumping into somebody, you know, accidents are an anomaly. But if you think of your mind as a Geiger counter, you know, that little machine that we measure radiation with, and you hear it go tick, 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 and it gets closer to radiation, and tick, 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 you know, the ticking picks up. If you think of your mind as sort of a Geiger counter, and you plant in your mind the things that are important to you, the things that you want, the things that are out there for you in the future that you want to achieve, just put those in the back of your mind. And as you go through life, as you walk through a shopping center, as you stand in line at the theater, as you're sitting on a bus or a tram, you may hear conversations. You may see something that triggers that thought, that triggers a connection, that then becomes a contact, that then becomes a point of reference, that then becomes an opportunity. For example, I was on a plane once going to San Francisco from Los Angeles, and I was with my wife. We were going up on a vacation, and two rows behind me was the managing director of the Spencer Stewart office in Los Angeles, John Westwater. I'll never forget it. And so we were getting off the plane, and I overheard him talking to the person next to him that they were having some trouble getting some traction in the marketplace in certain areas. And so as we were exiting the plane, you know, I turned around and said, "Oh, hi, John, you know, how are you doing?" Because we had met before in another event that was in Los Angeles. And I said, "You know, I couldn't help but overhear, you know, what you guys were talking about." And I said, I think I've got some ideas for you. I said, "Why don't we get together in LA when we get back?" He said, "Sure, yeah, come see me." Well, that was the beginning of a tremendous 10 years at Spencer Stewart. And so I really loved that, you know, that we got together, we had some ideas together and things, you know, one thing led to another and so on and so forth. So these things happen in life, but you have to be looking, you have to be aware of what they are, and you have to be ready to move on them. And so that's, to me, this is what serendipity is.
I completely agree. For example, for me, serendipity is something else because I focus on networking. I really like talking and studying and writing about networking, how to build a relationship with people. And serendipity plays a big role in that as well. because you can prepare and you should be preparing for everything, you know, if you want to meet people or if you want to provide value to build a relationship. But at the same time, you need to treat everybody the same way because you don't know. You will walk into the room and you don't know who is that person across the room. And he might be somebody who you will have a great time with. And even he might be somebody